Welcome to Wednesday afternoon. It is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to start this hour with an attempt to help our less fortunate citizens. Amazon has been experimenting with hiring homeless people in its retail warehouses. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols says the experiment didn't go so well.
Jackie Williams arrived in Seattle with nothing but a suitcase full of clothes. She came here from Dallas for a job as a certified nurse's assistant.
I came to Seattle to make money. That's what I came here to do, to get my money going.
But all her paperwork wasn't in order, and the job fell through. She found herself jobless and homeless.
You don't know where you're going to lay your head down. You don't know if somebody's going to do something to you. You know, every day, rain, sleet, or snow, you're outside. I'm like, oh my God, I'm not used to this.
Williams spent a lot of time at the YWCA. They have this big operation centered on connecting homeless people with jobs. They provide mock interviews, help people find a place to live, and give them counseling. Mike Schwartz runs the jobs program at the Y. One of his jobs is to convince businesses to hire people like Jackie Williams.
It's good business to hire people who have experienced homelessness. It's not that there aren't challenges, but it's good business.
Schwartz says it's good business because employers get tax breaks, and they get loyal employees who tend to stick around longer than average employees. Companies like Microsoft and Tom Douglas Restaurants have hired homeless people for years now. Amazon had been watching the trend, but hadn't really done much. But when it approached the Y last fall, it wanted to do something big that nobody else had done before in Seattle. Put on a job fair with only one employer there, Amazon, targeted specifically at homeless workers. Amazon told Schwartz the company would offer temporary to permanent positions in its distribution warehouses.
This was, I think, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity and a chance to create a role model for other employers.
But the holidays were approaching, so Amazon needed to hire people in a hurry. The Y would only have 1 week to put a job fair together. Mike Schwartz and his co-workers scrambled through preparations that usually take 3 weeks. Communicating with people who have no fixed address, coaching them to come up with a 30-second elevator pitch, helping them reframe their past hardships as strengths that would make somebody want to hire them.
I mean, it wasn't just crazy stressful, it was crazy exciting because we'd been wanting to work with Amazon for a long time.
Jackie Williams showed up at the Amazon job fair. She arrived to find 20 or so people struggling to fill out job applications. Not a huge turnout. Then the recruiter gave 11 of them the good news.
She said we were hired. We had the job. We were just waiting on the other part of the drug test. That's it.
And that's where the whole thing started to fall apart. First, there was the lack of communication that led to misunderstandings on both sides. The people who thought they were hired didn't hear from Amazon for weeks.
To do that to a homeless person, come on, that's not fair. Especially when they're already going through enough of being homeless.
When Amazon finally did call, some of the workers took the jobs, only to be laid off or have their hours cut dramatically a couple weeks after starting. There are so many things that the YWCA's Mike Schwartz did not realize about the kinds of jobs Amazon was offering. First, the jobs were night shift and swing shift positions. When you sleep in a homeless shelter, that's not going to fly because most homeless shelters close during the day and they don't let people just show up in the middle of the night. Jobs like that force homeless people to catch their sleep in places like public libraries. Then there was the fact that the jobs Amazon offered were seasonal. Schwartz says he'd been told the jobs could be made permanent if the workers performed well. That didn't happen, at least for the workers he knows about.
If you're homeless and you get a seasonal job, it may not help you very much in the long term. It may even hurt you. If you get a job that you believe will continue but turns out to be short term, you may have moved into permanent housing, thinking that you'll be able to pay your rent, and then all of a sudden the floor drops out from under you.
Then you could be facing an eviction, which can hurt your chance of landing an apartment later. Jackie Williams says Amazon really did more harm than good.
What you did was made them go deeper into depression is what you did. You really hurt someone when you do that, and you set them back when you do that.
Mike Schwartz says he believes the homeless job applicants got swept up in what is a common practice among big companies as the holidays approach. They tend to hire more people than they need, just in case.
Is it exploitive? Is it merely taking advantage of a body of workers who an employer may think are readily available to start the job and then to be subject to the demand of the employer in terms of their hours, their shifts, the workload itself?
He says it's normal for companies to face questions like this the first time they try to hire homeless workers. But he says what counts is that they keep trying and learning. He wishes he could talk to Amazon to learn what he could do differently next time. But
Amazon's a bit elusive. They're a bit hard to get a hold of.
Amazon wouldn't talk to us on tape for this story, but they did offer this written statement. We have partnered with numerous Seattle area nonprofits to provide employment opportunities to people who have experienced homelessness. This new program is in its early stages, but we believe it has promise. As for Jackie Williams, she will not attend the next job fair. She says she'll stay loyal to Swedish Medical Center. That's a company that stuck with her when she faced some obstacles getting certified as a nurse's assistant in Washington State. She's certified now. Also, she has a home now. She got an apartment through a program she learned about at the YWCA.
The lady called and said, you got approved. And I was like, thank you, Jesus. Oh, my God.
That means she'll actually have a place to sleep during the day when she's not working and a way to pay for it. In downtown Seattle, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
Happy way to end that story, Joshua. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Joshua McNichols with us live here on KUOW. So Amazon's experiment trying to hire homeless workers failed. But it doesn't mean it's the end of the story, right? What are the chances we're going to see more job fairs for homeless people in Seattle in the future?
Well, I put that question to Mike Schwartz, the guy at the YWCA, and he said he's already planning on bringing this event up, what happened at one of his next meeting with potential employers. He says he has a lot of employers who are sort of have been on the fence about having these targeted career fairs that are specifically targeted at this demographic. And he thinks that now that Amazon has tried it, some of them may be willing to follow that lead. But really, the idea depends on there being champions inside a company that can push for an idea. This idea didn't come from Jeff Bezos, as far as we can tell. It seemed to come from a guy, a kind of senior guy in the company named Hank Murphy, who pushed for this idea and sort of brought the company along with it. And in all the experiences that the guy at the YWCA has had, he said it's been one person in the company has sort of pushed for that change. Like, I reached out to Microsoft, and they didn't know a lot about their history of hiring people who'd experienced homelessness. But it really came down to one recruiter who had done that recruiting.
So how can companies, based on your reporting, Joshua, what do companies need to think about to make those programs more successful?
Well, service providers, you know, like the YWCA, but there are others, bring an enormous amount of resources to the process of helping somebody get and retain a job. You know, they've got wardrobes full of clothes for them to go to job interviews. They've got, they coach them through filling out their applications, and they do all this work. And then after they get the job, they help sort of counsel them to work through problems in transitioning to this day-to-day work environment. So the key is, you know, taking advantage of those resources requires good communication with the resource provider. Honestly, that may not always be a top priority for the companies that are experimenting with hiring this. They may just need to get people into a job quickly. They may not be able to give the service provider a month's notice before putting on a career fair like this. So they sort of have to decide. These companies have to decide how committed they are to work through some of these obstacles.
Yeah, it may be more complicated than they think. Why would companies go through all of this? What is in it for them?
Well, it could, for one thing, there's a labor market there that they can tap that other companies may be underutilizing. And many of the people who are homeless, many people have, some problems that are related to their homelessness. But other people just are, you know, there's people with skills that just found themselves on the street. And many of these workers could be really valuable to companies. Also, it's a potentially great PR move for companies that are often seen as contributing to the rising rents by bringing in people with, earning higher incomes from outside of the community. They could be seen as part of the solution to this. But it's a tricky story to tell because You know, maybe not all of the people who are being hired through programs like this want to broadcast to their peers, especially entering a new company, that they've experienced homelessness. They may want that to be – they may want to leave that part of their past behind.
Right. That's a good point. This KUOW's growth and development reporter, Joshua McNichols. Joshua, thanks so much for that.
Thank you, Bill.
We've been talking about Amazon's program to hire homeless workers. And if you missed any of that story, you can hear it later today on KUOW. You can hear it and share it with your friends online at KUOW.org. Coming up on KUOW's The Record, how is the Canadian dollar like a cauliflower?
I mean, it's a lumpy, tasteless, tumorous vegetable that I mostly avoid. I mean, go to any buffet. What's left on the vegetable plate when everything else is gone? It's the cauliflower.
And what does the price of that cauliflower tell us about life to the north? That's coming up in about 30 minutes on KUOW. You're with KUOW's The Record. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Bill Radke. Gender identity is something we're talking about more and more. Now, gender identity is not just something that adults think about. Kids wrestle with it, like this 8-year-old.
So when I was little, my mom didn't know that I was a girl, and I didn't like that, and I wanted to be a girl.
This child's mom has asked that we not use their real names to protect their privacy. The mom uses the name Marlo Mack, and she makes a podcast about her family's experiences. It's called How to Be a Girl. Mack and her child have also been talking with University of Washington psychologist Christina Olson. Last year, Olson started studying 30 transgender kids with supportive families. She told Marcy Silman it's common for parents to go through a period of denial about their child's gender identity.
Many of them report that when this behavior started to emerge, they actually reacted negatively, telling their kid they couldn't dress like the way they wanted, they couldn't use that term. Many of them took several years to get to a point where they realized, and often something unfortunately traumatic had to happen, like a child became withdrawn or anxious, or even in some cases, self-harm was involved. I mean, these are very young kids. And finally, the parents in my study reached a point where they said, okay, like, I need to do something. And some of them have had professionals say to them, you know, you're either going to have a child who's living and not the gender you thought they were, or you're not going to have a living child. And I think that kind of experience makes a lot of parents, you know, change their mind.
We're talking about prepubescent kids here, right?
Yes, absolutely. So all the kids that start our study, they haven't gone through puberty yet, though we're interested in following them during that time and after.
How early might a child express their gender identity out loud?
We've heard reports as early as basically when their kids start talking and could say words like girl and boy. So a lot of parents say 18 months, 2 years, it was pretty clear to them. That seems to interestingly be the same age at which other kids typically start to say, I'm a boy or I'm a girl. It just happens in these kids' case, the thing that they're saying they are is different from what their parents thought they were.
What is the line between a transgendered kid and a gender expression? How do we as parents or anybody else tell the difference?
Yeah, I think this is really difficult for everyone to do, and we don't have some magic test. I think that one thing that has been really important for me to understand has been that for a lot of these kids that we're talking about who are actually transgender, they have persistent and consistently identified as their gender identity. So this isn't a passing phase. This doesn't seem to be something that just crops up one day and goes away. And they importantly are saying, I am this thing. So it is not just saying, like, I like this thing that most people consider a boy thing, but I'm a girl. It is saying, like, I am a boy.
Well, let's talk about how you study. You use something called implicit measures to study gender identity in your trans youth project. What is an implicit measure and what does it tell you?
The basic idea is just take, let's say, an average little girl. If you have her do this sorting task, what you find is that she's faster to sort words like me and my and I when they're paired with pictures of little girls than when they're paired with pictures of little boys. And the research had shown that that's true of most kids. Boys show a faster association between themselves and boys, girls with girls. And so we said, well, can we use a measure like that to look at gender identity in transgender kids? And our basic finding is that using a measure like that, we cannot distinguish a transgender girl from another girl. They look completely identical, even though the kids themselves, some of these kids are as young as 5 years old. They don't even know what it is we're asking them to do. They don't know what it's tapping. But yet they look totally the same, suggesting that this identity they've been claiming seems to kind of be pretty deeply held and tapped even by these implicit measures.
So do you know where in a human being, a body or mind, this gender identity comes from?
No, I wish we did. That's kind of one of the many questions that I would like to answer, is to kind of understand why it is that any of us feel like I am a girl or I am a boy or I don't feel like I associate with either of those. And we don't know.
How do the findings that you have so far gathered from these prepubescent kids apply to kids after they hit puberty?
That's really my million-dollar question that I would like to answer, is what is the impact of being kind of allowed to live your gender identity? What is that going to do to their later life identity, their rates of depression, anxiety? Because we know that in transgender adults, those outcomes look bad. And so what we want to know is, well, is that a reflection of the fact that transgender people are extremely discriminated against? Is it that, you know, nearly all transgender adults today were not allowed to live as their gender identity as kids? So we just don't know what that's going to look like for them. Now, these are what I consider pioneers. They're gender pioneers because there aren't kids like this. There aren't adults like this who have had this life experience. So they're going to tell us, and they're going to tell future parents what that can look like in that environment.
Christina Olson is the director of the Trans Youth Project at the University of Washington. She's conducting a first-of-its-kind study of transgender kids and their families, and she talked about it with Marcy Silman last year. We will conclude now with a final thought from Marlo Mack and her child, who you heard from at the beginning of this piece.
Do you have any advice for kids who are transgender?
Like, well, if somebody keeps saying no, you're a girl, or no, you're a boy, don't give up. Just keep on convincing them. And get a grown-up if they tease you and all that kind of stuff. You don't give up on being transgender.
Do you think you would ever change your mind and want to be a boy?
No. I just want to be a girl who likes ninjas. Yeah.
That's a good answer.
Do you have any other questions?
No, not right now. Girl who likes ninjas. You can hear more of that family story and watch an animated video that Marlo Mack made about her family at KUOW.org. It's right there on the homepage. And in case you're on Twitter now, we'll tweet out a link to that story and that video. Remember, we're live tweeting now at KUOW. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. You can fight City Hall. So says former Seattle City Council member Nick Licata in his new book called Becoming a Citizen Activist. Until the alternative socialist Kshama Sawant came along, Licata was Seattle's most leftist office holder. KUOW's Ross Reynolds asked Licata if there is not some irony in him saying you can fight City Hall since he was in City Hall for 16 years.
Well, I was a citizen activist long before I got in the city council, and I think what I tried to do is continue to be an activist while I was on the city council.
I talked to Frank Chopp, the House Speaker, about this. He was an activist before he became a politician.
That's right.
And he said, being a political, when you're a successful politician, you are a political activist because you can't do things alone and you're rallying the community to support the issues that you want to have come forward. And he gave the example of getting people down to Olympia to testify. What do you think about that?
He's absolutely right. If you're going to be not just a successful politician, because there are some politicians who continue to get reelected, and in my estimation, they're not successful in making prominent, important, I would say, democratic changes.
You want to name some names?
No, I won't.
All right.
You can read the book. No. But I would say that if you're really going to make our democratic system work, then you have to involve people outside the political system. You have to involve the average person, and you have to let that person know and feel that they're going to have some leverage. I would say 9 times out of 10, I was in agreement with people who came to my office and said they wanted to do something. Usually it was around social justice or racial equity issues or economic opportunity things. And so I'd say, yeah, okay, let's do it. Don't spend your time trying to convince me. Let's talk about how we move forward on this. And that's what I'm trying to do with the book, is try to basically how to get something done.
You were the first person in your family to go to college?
First person to graduate from high school and go to college.
How did that influence you to become an activist?
I saw how my father, who never went beyond 8th grade, was actually a pawn on the chessboard. And my mother didn't graduate either. She was forced out. She was an orphan, and her guardians forced her to quit high school so they would support them. They didn't really have many opportunities. They made the best they could. But it often seemed to me that their future was being decided by other people. They really didn't do the things they wanted to do, even though they had talent. And I just decided that that's not right.
What was the first time you became a citizen activist?
One of the first things that occurred to me was that you cannot expect the people who have authority to always look out for your interests. And that really came across on the playground. And I was at a Catholic school, and there were—
Those nuns were not looking out for you?
They weren't looking out for me. There was this— actually, looking out for anyone, actually. There was this this kid who was overweight and was being chased by these other folks, other boys in the playground. They were just jumping all over him. And I saw this nun there who's the playground, and I said, you know, hey, you got to do something. This kid's being, like, you know, pounced on. And her response was, he'll take care of himself. And that was like, and I really the true believer in a sense of, you know, the church knew everything. They were going to watch out. And when that happened, it was like, okay, I get it. You really have to work with others if you're going to get something done.
And did you?
And I did, yes.
What'd you do?
Well, basically, that was 3rd grade, but as I went forward, I actually started an underground newspaper in high school. But in college is where I really sort of blossomed.
And what campus was this?
This was Bowling Green State University. Mm-hmm. And I joined, at that time, it's called Students for Democratic Society, SDS. We were accused of being communists. And I had grown up, my dad was a barber, reading John Birch material, because that's all John Birch just came and got his haircut. And so I was familiar with this conspiracy theory, and I realized, oh, I see. It's like everyone thinks there's a conspiracy out there controlling, you know. The communists were controlling us, these youths who just basically had some ideas. And I organized the campus to think about what their concerns were. And using that as a theme, I ran for student body president, and I won. I won against actually the most well-known fraternity guy on campus.
So a politician early on.
Early on.
But I got to ask you about the people might be surprised to hear that Nick Licata, well-known kind of lefty guy's father, had John Birch Society material in his barbershop that he ran to.
Oh,
did he like that stuff himself?
To a certain extent. I mean, I read that material before I read anything else.
So your dad, who has this John Birch material, sees his son Nick go to college, become politically active.
Right.
What was that interaction like with him when you went in that direction?
You know, I thought he was going to be like very negative and react against it. He wasn't. I mean, to a certain extent, he was still a creature of his environment. I mean, to him, it was like, oh, that's a, when I became student body president, oh, that's a nice gavel. You know, it was at that level.
Nick Licata is outgoing Seattle City Council member, and he's talking to me about his new book. It's called Becoming a Citizen Activist, which is a really a guidebook, and it goes through a lot of issues that he worked with here in Seattle, analyzes them in short form, and comes up with some lessons learned from them to pass on to people that would like to be citizen activists. And one of them that struck me was there was a debate in the city over whether we should outlaw aggressive panhandling.
Right.
City Council member Tim Burgess pushed for that.
Yes.
And you drew an important lesson from the activists who successfully challenged that and persuaded the mayor to veto that legislation.
Yes.
And what was that message?
Well, the message was, I think, that you have to attack the underlying assumptions often that people make for why they want to get bad legislation passed. In this case, the underlying assumption was panhandlers are criminals, essentially. They're threatening. They're going to hurt you. And the second lesson was, if you attack that underlying assumption, what are the facts? What's the data? And we went out and got the data, and we analyzed it and showed that there was no correlation whatsoever.
And it was the very same data that Tim Burgess was using to say we needed to criminalize
exactly.
aggressive panhandling.
Yes. Yes.
But looking at it more deeply, you found counter indications
right.
within the information.
Right. At heart, I'm actually a researcher. I like being an investigative reporter because I think there's excitement in discovering new things that demolish myths.
Demolishing myths. That's the former Seattle City Council member Nick Licata, whose new book is called Becoming a Citizen Activist: Stories, Strategies, and Advice for Changing Our World. He talked with KUOW's Ross Reynolds. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. It's 12:48. Checking international news for you now. The oldest Christian monastery in Iraq has been reduced to rubble. The 14-year-old St. Elijah's Monastery in Mosul was a holy site for Iraqi Christians for centuries, and then Islamic State fighters took over that area in summer of 2014, and we didn't know what happened to this monastery. And now satellite photos show it has joined a growing list of religious sites and historic sites demolished by Islamic militants. Good afternoon. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Canada is taking in more Syrian refugees than the United States is, but that doesn't mean it's been easy. The group handling the settlement of refugees in Vancouver has now asked the city to hold off accepting any more refugees from Syria. CBC radio host Stephen Quinn says the hold on refugees is only a temporary one.
We're talking about a number of days here, but what's happened is with the number of government-sponsored refugees who have been arriving in Vancouver, in the Lower Mainland, the Immigrant Services Society of BC, which is tasked with helping settle these people, says it can't keep up. Most of the about roughly 700 government-sponsored refugees who have arrived here remain in temporary housing. And here's the thing, the government-sponsored refugees, for a family of five, they get a monthly allowance of about $800. And I don't know if you know anything about the Vancouver real estate market or the rental market, but trying to find anywhere to live for that amount of money is virtually impossible. That's all the money they get. So right now we've got people, most of them, the vast majority of them, still in temporary housing. The ISS says it's got leads on some affordable apartments, but it is proving much more difficult to get these people into housing than was originally anticipated. So Vancouver and the city of Ottawa as well have just asked to stop taking in refugees for a short period of time until they can clear out some of that backlog from the temporary housing, get some people into permanent housing.
British Columbia has taken in hundreds of Syrian refugees in the last 6 months or so. Generally, how has their resettlement gone so far?
You know, I think it depends on whether they are government-sponsored refugees or privately sponsored refugees. A number of individuals, families, faith groups have got together. They've put up the money to take in even a couple of families. And it's an expensive proposition because when they do that, they take on the responsibility of everything this family needs. needs for their first year in Canada. So their housing, their food, any courses they might need. On that track, it seems to be a lot smoother than it does on the government-sponsored track right now. There are backlogs, though, in such things as ESL. People are arriving. They don't speak the language, and it's taking months for some people to get into English as a second language training, not to mention, you know, which, of course, makes it very difficult to get a job. But just navigating their way around as well. I mean, we're talking about people who arrive at the airport, you know, families of five, six and seven people who know nothing about what it's like to live here. And again, the Lower Mainland, Vancouver and southern British Columbia, very, very expensive place to live.
Speaking of expensive, on a different subject here, Stephen, the Canadian dollar is very cheap to the U.S. dollar right
yes,
now.
Yes, it is, Bill. Thank you for reminding us.
Well, one more image I want from you. This is symbolized somehow by a head of cauliflower?
I don't know where this came from, but somehow there's a mythical $8 head of cauliflower out there. I haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. My own experience is I have been able to purchase cauliflower for substantially less than that. But fresh food, of course, most of it imported into Canada at this time of year, has shot up in price because of the value of the Canadian dollar. Where are we today? 68, 69 cents to the U.S. dollar. Somehow, cauliflower has come to symbolize this to the point where there's a hashtag out there, cauliflower crisis. But it seems to be, and I don't know why anyone would choose cauliflower. I mean, it's a lumpy, tasteless, tumorous vegetable that I mostly avoid. I mean, go to any buffet. What's left on the vegetable plate when everything else is gone? It's the cauliflower. So the unsung hero of the Canadian dollar crash so far. And if I do spot an $8 cauliflower, I will be sure to let you know.
I'm going to convert you. Olive oil, some Indian spices, and high temperature, you're going to be a changed man.
Roasting it, are you?
Yes, I'm roasting it for you.
I know. I was my mother wrecked cauliflower for me at an early age.
That's if you can afford it in the first place.
Well, exactly. Only rich people have cauliflower. It's cauliflower for everybody.
Let them eat tumorous vegetables. Now, the one more thing here, Stephen. The British Columbia government has just released its report on the Stanley Cup hockey riot of 2011 that we may remember here. I do. I remember it. What more is there to say about that riot?
Yeah, I watched it from outside the window of this very studio that night and reported live on it.
Did you? Tell me about that.
Well, it was crazy because the Canucks lost the Game 7 against Boston. People came out of the arena. They poured out onto the street where thousands had gathered to watch it on the big screens outside. Things started getting ugly very quickly. We were supposed to be doing a kind of a sports broadcast to talk about the game, but of course, within minutes, we saw what was going on outside when the first police car caught fire. So that was 4.5 years ago now. And the final report has come in from Crown Counsel, from the prosecution. Here's an interesting number, though. The total amount of damage done by that riot was about somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 million. It cost $5 million to prosecute everybody who was charged in this. So 912 charges were laid against about 300 people, most of them adults. 284 of them ended up pleading guilty, and there were only 10 trials out of the whole thing. Not a proud moment for Vancouver, not a proud moment for hockey fans, but certainly interesting to see these numbers and interesting to see how much damage was done and how much it cost to finally prosecute the whole thing.
Yes, good money thrown after a waste of a riot.
Really, really a low point in this city, I think.
That's Stephen Quinn, host of the CBC One radio show on the coast in Vancouver, and he also writes a column for the Globe and Mail. He started out talking about Syrian refugees. Here's an update on that from Congress, a measure that would have stopped the admission of Syrian and Iraqi refugees to the United States has been blocked by Senate Democrats. At one point, the minority leader, Harry Reid, a Democrat, offered to let the bill advance only if Republican leaders agreed to permit a vote to denounce Donald Trump's proposal to bar Muslims from entering the United States. The Republicans didn't go along with that. This is KUOW.